All right, well, thanks, Chris, and a lot of thanks to Perimeter Institute, where I'm going to be all year, for having me here. It's always been one of my favorite places to be and sort of an intellectual paradise that has many of the things I like to do, philosophy, quantum foundations, quantum information, even some thinking about complex systems and economics all in one place. So it's an amazing place. I'm glad to be here. This is going to be work done with some collaborators. Cosmin Udadek, who's here at Waterloo, and he's also at Perimeter, at least he has an office at Perimeter as well. Joe Emerson at Waterloo, who's Cosmin's PhD advisor in applied math. Alex Wills, and this is some work on steering I may get to, and some work on teleportation with John Barrett, Matt Liefer, and Alex Wills, and you'll see how it's related to spectrality in Jordan state spaces as we go on. So here's an overview of the talk. First of all, I want to globally set the environment to finite dimensional vector spaces. I had written up the talk with some of the details for infinite dimensional situations, but I was advised, let's try to keep it simple. So there may be some residues of this, you know, infinite dimensional stuff, so something like norm exposed something, or but basically, you can do a lot of this in infinite dimensions, but we'll be dealing with a finite dimensional situation. Okay, so an overview, I'm gonna introduce multiple slit experiments and Sorkin's notion of higher order interference, which is going to be one of the major themes of the talk. Then I'm gonna review the convex sets framework and the notion of a spectral convex set, or its finite dimensional equivalent is actually projective convex set, one in which every face of the set has a very nice projection onto it and a complementary projection with all sorts of nice properties. Then I'll quickly talk about the Alfsane, so Eric Alfsane and Frederick Schultz, characterization of state spaces of formerly real Jordan algebras via spectrality plus some things called the pure state properties. And then I'll apply spectrality to this first topic, higher order interference in convex operational models. This is the work I mentioned with Cosmin and Joe. And then if we have time, which we may not, I will get to the rest of the topics, the Kosher-Vinberg characterization that Alex already mentioned of Jordan state spaces. And I'll talk about some ways of using steering and teleportation to give an information processing motivation or understanding of homogeneity and get a little ways towards self-duality as well. And then, you know, there's this Alfsane-Schultz characterization, and also Alex gave one earlier this week of Jordan state spaces. And I'll give a little motivation of at least one of those axioms from teleportation, the transitivity on pure states. Again, if there's time for these topics. And then I'll review at the conclusion. All right, I encourage questions during the talk. I think, you know, it's always possible I've forgotten to define some important concept without which you'll be confused. So please just pipe up and ask for it. Okay, so don't forget to do that. If you're confused and you've been more or less attempting to pay attention. All right, so interference is a hallmark of quantum phenomena. The two-slit experiment is its famous manifestation. And what is interference in the two-slit experiment? Well, we have some screen over here. Maybe we have some little region of the screen between x and x plus dx. And over here we have a barrier with two slits, one and two. And we have a source of particles here, right? Some oven or something. And quantum particles go out, maybe very rarely. So we're pretty sure there's only one quantum particle ever going through this thing. You know, or maybe it's a photon source or something. In any case, so interference has to do with the fact that the probability, if we block off this slit, that a particle gets here, and if we consider what happens if we block off the other slit, the probability that a particle is observed in this region of the screen, and you add those up, and you compare it to the probability that a particle gets through if both slits are open, it's not necessarily the same. It could be larger. There could be constructive interference if both slits are open, larger than the sum. This could be larger than the sum, or it could be smaller than the sum. There's destructive interference. So it's not the same. And so the difference between these two probabilities, they're probabilities for this event conditional on Sorry, they're not two probabilities, but this sum of probabilities and this probability, all of these are conditional on, you know, these are conditional on different experimental setups. So they're getting at the quantum idea that there are alternative experiments one can do, and comparing those. The difference is the prototype for a quantity that Raphael Sorkin defined as part of a hierarchy of interference qualities, and this is the second one. Okay, the first one basically just says that, well, the probability isn't zero. We don't have nothing there. So it's just the additivity of probabilities to one. I think classical theory satisfies it. I2 is the first one that's not satisfied by classical probabilities. And there's a whole infinite hierarchy of them, all of which are satisfied by classical theory. And so I'll tell you a little bit about those. So Sorkin's measures specify the probabilities of a fixed event, and that's like arriving in some fixed region of the screen, conditional on each possible set of mutually disjoint slits being open. So the idea is now there are, let's say, k slits. So 1, 2, 3, here's k equals 4. Maybe we should draw k equals 3, actually, since that's an important case. Okay, so we have 1, 2, 3 slits here. And then we're going to look at all possible subsets of the slit, both sets conditioning, that might be open. So we could have one slit open in each of three ways. We could have two slits open in each of three ways. And we're going to compare all those probabilities in such a way that we... get a reasonable notion of what higher order interference might be. So in a three-slit experiment, is there any kind of interference that isn't sort of captured by all of the two-slit sub-experiments? And so here's the quantity. So let's take the slits to be subsets of some S. Let's let there be K slits. This shouldn't be J, I guess this should be S. Oh, no, J is a subset, so that's right. So S is the, let's say, let's just label the slits 1 through K. So for any subset of them, we just find A sub J to be their union. So here's the formula for the general interference quantity of Sorkin. You just, you have some measure, which is actually the probability of observing this event at the screen. And when the idea is when we plug in some set, that's telling us which slits are open, and this should give us the probability of observing a particle at this position in the screen. If the experiment is set up with exactly those slits open. And so we take this alternating signed sum, so we sum over all different numbers of slits that might be open. We have an alternating sign depending on the number of slits. We always want the largest term here to be positive, so we have minus one. And then the, we just add up the measure for all subcollections of slits of that size. And so the idea is that by doing this, we're kind of subtracting all of the, Nick?
Is that just from A, B, and C, or is that supposed to be?
Where's A, B, and C? Yeah, that's a misprint. Sorry. A1, A2, A3, and A1, A2 up here. Indecision about notation. So here's I2. Just like we said before, it's the probability of getting through when both slits are open minus the sum of the probabilities of getting through each slit when that's the only slit open. Okay, here what we're effectively trying to do is, if you look at what we're subtracting from this probability, right. So what I want to say, and I won't go through exactly, but is that if you add up the probabilities of getting through with each possible set of two slits open, and you kind of compare that to the probability for getting through with three slits open, and you deal appropriately with overcounting due to the fact that you're adding maybe two experiments in which the same slit is open, this should sort of be telling you whether You know, just as in the first case, there's any difference between the sum of two slits open and both the sum of each slit open and both slits open, is there any difference between summing each way two slits can be open and having all three slits open? So this is the notion of kth order interference. Again, zero beyond zero for two through infinity for classical theory. And in any theory, well, here are a few statements about it. For any theory, if it's zero at one level, then it's zero the rest of the way up. So it's a hierarchy of conditions. It's kind of obvious that sums and multiples of level k measure. So we call something a level k measure if ik is not zero, but ik plus one is zero for all higher levels. And so sums and multiples of level k measures are again level k measures. So it's a linear space, and I guess you could think of the positive valued ones as a cone. You can see where we might be going with that. Okay, Sorkin was interested in using this notion in a histories rather than a states formalism for quantum theory. So he had events at different places in a space-time, and he wanted to look at interference between them. We're going to take it to states anyway, maybe against Raphael's spirit in which he invented it, and we're going to try to port it to the convex states framework that people talked about a little bit earlier this week. So one way to begin is maybe to make dependence on the final observable outcome explicit. And attempt to give a full description of all multiple slits experiments with some fixed set of slits. So this is basically like requiring that a measure be able to deal with every little division of what's on the screen. And since we're going to finite dimensions, we'll imagine a discrete screen in which these are actually like points. Or more abstractly, the screen is just going to be represented by some observable in a convex theory. And the places on the screen are just the different generalized POVM elements, the different measurement outcomes. Okay, so let's see. But we're actually going to try to allow multiple different sets of slits and screens. So roughly, we're going to replace the Boolean algebra of subsets of 1 to n, which is what Raphael was dealing with multiple such algebras, which you might think of as different barriers. And what these barriers are going to correspond to is basically sublattices of the lattices of compressions of a spectral or projective convex set. And I'll tell you what all that stuff means. Compressions are a very special kind of projection. The compressions in quantum mechanics, and let me know if I'm standing in front of this picture or should we have the lights on? I don't know. So in quantum mechanics, right, compressions act on density matrices. That's important. These are acting on mixed states. And a typical compression, if pi is a projector on the Hilbert space, then a compression p takes rho to pi rho pi. So that's a compression. I mean, it so happens that these things, I mean, yeah, this is an idempotent linear map on the Hilbert space. You do it twice, you get the same thing. I mean, on the density matrix space, you do it twice, you get the same thing. But it also has a lot of other nice properties. It has a unique sort of canonical complement, for instance. Okay, so I guess, can people read this, or should we go back to lights off? I mean, what's the relative? Yeah, why don't we turn it off? All right. Okay, and probably we don't actually need to require for modeling multiple slit experiments that these things are compressions, but it's what I feel most comfortable with. You know, Cosmin and I have been talking about what less you can do, and he thinks you can get by with something weaker.
Something weaker being something like a more general.
Well, it's not very much weaker. Not very much weaker. I mean, yeah, so we're also curious as to whether you can use, you know, for instance, in quantum mechanics, well, okay, so there are different questions, right? Could you use Sorkin's quantities, but generalize them not by compressions, but by some slightly weaker type of thing that's still a projection on the set? So what Araki called filters in his 1980 paper, for instance. Or could you, maybe by rewriting the definition of interference conditions, even extend it to transformations other than even some kind of projections. But if you do that, you've got to be careful, because you can create things, if you just allow arbitrary Krauss operators, you can create things in classical mechanics, I mean, in classical probability theory, by adding noise that look like interference. Certainly if you use Raphael's definition, you can do that, and you probably don't want to do that. And that's part of the motivation for, you know, going with these projections. These slits in the screen aren't supposed to be kind of like filters, and what's going on in interference is saying, you know, it must somehow disturb the state, you know, even to just divide these two slits, you know, to find out which slit it went through. Even though this slit shouldn't be disturbing and this slit shouldn't be disturbing, somehow, if you have something that could go through both, knowing where it went does disturb. So we haven't gone too far with that, but it would be nice to see how far you can go with general Krauss operators. Yes. Okay. So now I'm going to show you a little more of the details of how to get this in the context sets framework. And first, we're going to introduce the framework and define projective or spectral convex sets. I'll try to go very quickly because some of this has already been covered. So, all right, a cone in a real vector space is a set which I usually call A plus, a subset of the space A. It's closed under positive. Positive scalar multiplication and addition, and that's all we need. So here's an example, right? Here's R2, and this shaded thing, including these rays, is the cone. Okay, this notion is pretty much equivalent to the notion of, one more property we're going to require for our cones. They're pointed, right? So if I drew R2, and I just looked at the whole right half plane and this whole axis, that's a cone, by the definition that only includes A and B, which a lot of people like to call a wedge, but it has a linear subspace in it, so it's not a pointed cone, and we're not going to call it a cone. So an ordered linear space is a linear space, a vector space, with an ordering on it. You can add the inequalities, and you can multiply the inequalities by positive scalars. Well, having a distinguished cone of this type in your vector space makes the space into an ordered linear space. You just say A is bigger than B if B minus A is in the cone. So, you know, if the vector space is the real line, it's the standard ordering. A is greater than B if A minus B is positive. Well, here A is less than or equal to B if B minus A is okay. Okay, so conversely, given such an order, and I had a little worry about whether the ordering has to be Archimedean, say it doesn't, thanks. So maybe I should... Well, I should note that, but, yeah, all right. So I just got worried about that late last night. Yeah.
So, what's a distinguished cone?
Oh, I'm just saying, if you distinguish a cone, dub it the positive cone. So you have a vector space, you want it to be an ordered linear space. If you specify a cone, that specifies an ordering, canonically. Because now I can say, A is bigger than B, greater than or equal to B, if I subtract B from A, and it's in that cone. You can pick different, yeah, you can pick different cones, and you get different orderings on the same underlying vector space. It's your choice. Yeah, so distinguished isn't an adjective with any additional meaning. Okay, so this orderings, you know, orderings are equivalent to distinguished such cones. And Garrett says we don't have to worry about Archimedean. So, well, I'm thinking of an ordering. So I'm just thinking, what about R2 plus with the lexicographic ordering? Or R2, where you have a lexicographic ordering? It seems like an ordering, I'm worried that it's a little bit weird. But, okay. Yeah, so maybe the point is that there's no Archimedean order unit for that ordering. But, I mean, so the positive cone is still R2 plus. If you give it, so lexicographic ordering, you know, says x, y is greater than or equal to w, z. Whenever x is greater than or equal to w, And if there's a tie, then you use the second coordinate. And so that has the standard, you know, right, upper right quadrant as its positive cone. But okay, you can't introduce an order unit for it, I guess. All right, so that's sort of getting ahead of things. So we say V plus is generating if it spans the vector space it's in, and we also say the vector space is positively generated. That's the jargon. So I'm going to call it one regular if it's generating, and also topologically closed. Okay, a base for the cone is just gotten by slicing across it with a hyperplane. So let me give you, so here's a base B for this cone C. And you know, a less trivial example, you might have a Lorentz cone which looks like that. You slice the hyperplane, you get a disk, and that's the state space of a real quantum bit, for instance. Still pretty simple. Okay, so this base is automatically convex, and if the cone's regular, the base is compact. And we're going to interpret a distinguished base as the normalized states. And so you can get such a base by specifying a linear functional in the dual space, and it has to be in the strictly in the interior of the dual cone. What's the dual cone? It's just a set of linear functionals that are positive on your primal, on everything in your primal cone. If this thing is strictly in the interior, then it slices nicely through the middle, and you get this compact convex set of normalized states. They're just the states on which this U is equal to 1. And those are sort of the way we represent the normalized states of a theory. It could come from a test space, or you could just specify it straight this way. Okay, what's a base norm space? This jargon gets in there a lot. I used to not like to talk about the base norm and anything, but it's kind of cool. And it's something you'll repeatedly encounter in the literature, so I guess it's worth learning about. And I've been envisioning this talk as partly pedagogical, and I'll also talk about our new results on interference. So what's a base norm space? Well, it's a regularly ordered vector space, V, but it's equipped with a norm, obviously. And you can specify a norm by just specifying its unit ball. What is the unit ball for a base norm? It's the convex hull of K and minus K, where K is a base for the cone. So let's draw this Lorentz cone, and let's go down here. Can everybody sort of see that? This is minus K. We've gone, you know, we have three axes here. And what's the convex hull of these? It's this cylinder. All right, so the cylinder is the unit ball of the base norm of a real bit. Okay.
What does that mean? I mean, I see what you drew, I understand the definition, but so what? What does it mean that the cylinder...
I'll tell you a little more about what it means. But, you know, it means that, it just means that you can use a lot of the theory of normed linear spaces to do things that you would be maybe trying to do with just thinking about convexity. And sometimes it's useful to be able to do that. That's one thing it means, right? So a contractive map in the base norm is a positive map, a map that takes the cone into itself, and that takes everything below the base. It's what you'd call a quantum operation. So quantum operation, this lingo, is a norm contractive map. Well, okay, there are some norm contractive maps actually that aren't completely positive, so subtle stuff arises, but anyway, let's just run with this for a while. Another operational motivation for it is that it's connected to the same operational motivation. So the base norm distance will give you the optimal distinguishing probability, right? Just like it is the you know, the one norm distance in quantum mechanics is the base norm distance, and that's a very operational thing because it gives you the optimal probability for distinguishing the two states, you know, the norm of the difference of the states. Same thing in general theory. So there's a motivation for it, if that helps. Okay, another motivating fact. So on positive elements, the base norm agrees with the unit functional used to define the base. So now the quote-unquote normalized states are normalized in the sense of really having unit norm in terms of a norm vector space. I don't know, maybe that's mathematically useful. Anyway, you pretty much have to understand it to understand some of the most important literature on this convex operational framework coming from the mathematics literature. Okay, measurement outcomes are, they're just elements of the dual cone. because you want it to be positive and linear, linearly dependent on the state. Dual to the cone of unnormalized states. And, excuse me? Okay. I managed to confuse your computer, Mara. That's good. Okay. And since they have to be less than one, they belong to the unit interval in this ordering, right? They're between zero and the order unit, right? The order unit is one on all states. It doesn't really tell you anything. It's just like taking the trace of the density matrix in quantum mechanics. Okay. Maximal, so these are, if we think of a theory where we take the full unit interval in the dual space as our effects, that's a what I like to call a maximal operational model for a system. We use all mathematically consistent effects. And so if you want to have a hidden variables model, you know, you want to include hidden variable models of non-classical theories, you'll probably want to go beyond this assumption. So a little warning there. Okay, the dual normed linear space, if you start with the normed linear space, say V, it's the space of linear functionals on V. It's infinite dimensional, you need this, you know, continuity, equipped with the dual norm. And what is that? Well, it's the supremum over normalized elements of the primal space of the absolute value of, the norm of A is the supremum over elements of the primal space of A applied to the normalized element, the absolute value you can get by applying, A to a normalized element. So for effects, it's the highest probability that you can get for that effect by applying it to a state. Okay, I think I'll skip this Archimedean business, but so you want some technical conditions to have these things be well-behaved. And if you have an Archimedean order unit, that's this element in strictly in the interior of the positive cone, you make the vector space into a so-called order unit space. So given the time, I think I won't go into too much detail. But the main point is that certainly in finite dimensions, and you need to say a little bit more in infinite dimensions, if you start with a base norm space, then if you look at the dual space and you let its unit ball be the interval between minus the order unit and the order unit, that is the dual norm space to be, and it is an order unit space. And so what does it look like in our Lorentz example? Just to make things slightly more concrete. Well, in the case of the Lorentz cone, so here's the cone, maybe here's some base up here just to give the shape, and here's our order unit. So, you know, for a real bit, this is just the 2x2 identity matrix. Okay, we want to, thank you. So first let's look at our unit interval, right, our effects. Well, they're basically everything that's between u and zero, and that just means we take the cone, a copy of the cone, stick it upside down, put its point at u, and here we have some circular cross-section. So there's this kind of double-pointed cone that's the order, that's the interval of effects. And the unit interval, the convex, it is convex, the unit ball for the norm is the same thing, but it's bigger because it goes down to minus u here. So that's sort of the geometry. And so these norms are intimately related to the objects of operational interest, namely the order unit. This thing is basically the same shape as the unit interval. Okay, another interesting fact, the non-zero extremal points of this, so I said that, you know, the unit interval is the same shape as the unit ball, which is smaller. Okay, the non-zero extremal points of this interval have unit norm. That's a nice fact. So what are the non-zero extremal points in here? Everybody can pretty much see this. Is that right or not? What are they? Well, they're u. Here's zero. It doesn't have unit norm. Think about a unit ball. What does it mean in terms of the norm? Everything that's, you know, out on the outside of the unit ball, we're in finite dimensions here, on the boundary of the unit ball, has norm 1. Now, so that means these guys all have norm 1. These guys all have norm 1. So in particular, everything around here has norm 1. So these are the extremal, these are some more extremal points, if you think about it, in this convex set. And they do have norm 1. And these are the atomic ones. These happen to be the atomic ones. What does atomic mean? It means they're on extremal rays. So they're minimal. You can't get them by adding any two other extremal effects together. And sure enough, these atomic ones all have norm 1. And so does U. And if you have a set that has even more, like some, this set doesn't actually have any non-trivial, non-atomic effects. But if we were to take, let's say, a classical state space of three distinguishable states and look at the simplex as the, so the triangular normalized state space, what does the unit interval look like? It actually looks like a cube, right? So here, this is the effect, let's say, 1, 0, 0. And there's an effect that is maybe 0, let's call it this 0, 0, 1. Yeah, OK, and then there's one in here, which is 0, 1, 0. And then there's 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. That's the order unit for a classical three-state system. And this is 110. Okay. So what are the atomic effects? Well, first let's draw on the rest of the cube. Just extend this outwards. Sorry, not the cube, but the cone. And extend that line outwards. The cone is the positive quadrant, right, of unnormalized effects. The atomic effects are these guys. And then there are some extremal in the unit interval, but not atomic effects, which are coarse grainings of these guys. Here's another one. It's probably 110. No, 101. Okay. And then there's the order unit. So there's an example where you have some non-atomic effects. So again, this is sort of pedagogical to help you understand a bit what people are talking about when they're talking about atomic effects and so forth. Okay. Right. And then I think I've discussed this already, right? The norm of an unnormalized state is the highest, quote-unquote, probability it gives for a legitimate effect, an effect in the unit interval. Yes, Nick?
As far as I'm concerned, because I don't know what atomic effect generally means, you've defined it in terms of this cone. What else does it mean? What are you trying to connect it to? What's an atomic effect?
Well, I'm trying to, it's not a sum of any other extremal effects, right? So it's extremal, right? When you're like optimizing, doing convex optimization over what effect should I use, that might come up.
Okay, but in a more physical setting, is it a like projective measurement, or is it?
Well, in quantum mechanics, it's a one-dimensional projection. Yeah, it's an effect that is a one-dimensional projection.
Okay.
It's the atomic effects. Yeah.
In classical mechanics, it's a particular outcome?
Well, I wouldn't call this mechanics, but in classical probability theory, it's a definite outcome.
Yeah. Okay.
It's the most fine-grained outcome in your sample space, I guess. All right.
I was wondering, you'll be able to back the other way a long way if you say the discrimination metric.
You might be, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't guarantee it, but I sort of suspect that. And thinking about that kind of stuff in operational terms might give you some more motivation for choices that have to be made in the infinite dimensional case. Okay, I wanted to find a face of the convex set, because we're going to try to talk about compressions and spectrality. So basically, it's a subset of the convex set that is closed under inclusion of everything that can be that can enter into a convex combination to give you something in the set. So if I have a convex combination with probabilities pi of elements xi, and this is a representation of something in the face, xi are things in the convex set, then xi should be in the face. That's a misprint. That should be f. Okay, what are faces in quantum mechanics? Well, what are they in classical mechanics or classical probability theory, right? Let's take our simplex, three simplex again. Okay, well, the extreme points are faces. The edges are also faces. And the whole thing is a face. That's it. In quantum mechanics, faces correspond one-to-one to subspaces of the Hilbert space. I probably say this here. Nah. Okay, I don't. They correspond one-to-one to subspaces of the Hilbert space. And a face is just the set of density operators that is supported, a face corresponding to a subspace is the set of density operators that are supported within that subspace. So pictorially, you know, if you like to drop a density operator in some basis that's compatible with your subspace decomposition, and maybe this is a basis for your subspace S, all the density matrices that are zero here and anything you want up there, those are a face. And this, if it's zero everywhere here and something down there, that's a so-called complementary face, which we'll get to. All right, exposed face is the intersection of a supporting hyperplane with a convex set. And it's not too important what the difference between exposed and non-exposed is. So I'll go into it at the moment. Okay, now let's get to defining projections. So for a linear map T, let's define the positive kernel of the map as just the ordinary kernel in linear space terms intersected with the positive cone. And similarly for the positive image. Okay, what's a positive map? It's linear and it preserves the cone. So T of the cone is equal to the cone. It doesn't take positive stuff to non-positive stuff that has no conceivable operational interpretation. Okay, what's a projection? Well, it's an idempotent positive linear map. I'm going to call that a projection. Okay, so it's a fact that for projections, the positive kernel is a face of the cone. And the image of the cone, just the image, the vector space, is positively generated. So it's generated by the positive image. And actually, so the Kerr plus P is actually a exposed face. Okay, I guess I'm not going to give any examples. So we say two projections are complementary if the positive kernel of one is equal to the positive image of the other, and vice versa. Okay, and so in general, complements aren't unique. Okay, so never we're trying to define very special projections that have a canonical complement, for one thing, like we have in quantum mechanics. Okay, so we say they're bicomplementary if both the projections and their duals, these act on the dual space, they're defined in the usual way, you define an adjoint, are complementary. So these are just the Heisenberg picture versions of these, if you want to think of it that way. Okay. I think I'll skip smoothness, and I'll skip this. And I'll skip that. Okay, and now let's define a compression. And now this business about separating order and norm duality, this is sort of left over from infinite dimensions. So A, just a second, Nick, I'll get you in a second. Let's think of A as B dual ordered by the dual cone and leave it at that, yes?
What are we doing?
We're defining compressions.
No.
The overall goal is to define compressions in order that we can formulate interference in the convex framework, Sorkin's higher order levels of interference. To do that, it's convenient to be able to define these compressions because they have properties without which it's not clear that those things will make sense. You may be able to weaken it slightly and have that make sense.
Okay, so physically, I know it is mathematical,
yeah.
But the compression is
well, so you can think of the image of the compression. It has a lot of nice properties, right? It's like a information preserving subsystem, Robin Blum Kahoot might say. You can tell if you're in it, and by looking to see if you're in it, you don't destroy the information that you may have stored there. And there's this unique complement that is, you know, sort of about not being in it. And then if you take a maximally fine-grained compatible set of these compressions, it's pretty much like having you know, a set of faces that if you just consider them with respect to each other and take convex combinations, everything behaves very classically. Just like a basis in quantum mechanics, right? So if we take these faces and we maximally fine-grain, we just get a basis and we look at everything that's compatible with that set of compressions. It's like a classical sub-theory. So getting, just being very vague about it, compressions are sort of related to notions of classical sub-theories.
Okay, but basically, I mean, it's just a way of selecting it. I mean, you have a basis.
Yeah.
There's projections in that basis, and they all correspond to these. I mean,
compression
and a projection?
Well, there's a projection. If you want to call a projection just idempotent linear mapping on the state space.
I know, but physically.
Well, for one thing, those things don't have.
To just point out, this is what it is.
Well, okay, so they do have this property of neutrality, for one thing, right? They act as filters. So if you don't change the norm of the state, you don't change the state, right? So if it's in that space, you don't mess it up. Okay, that's one property. That's one of the most important properties they have. That, you know, so that's not a problem in quantum mechanics, because all the compressors have that property. But if you wanted to generalize this notion to of interference to general convex state spaces, you'll have plenty of idempotents in general that don't have that property. So that's one nice property they have that general things don't. Having a unique complement is another. Okay, so we define a compression, well, it has to be normalized, and it has to be bicomplemented. So bicomplemented means both P and Q are complemented, and so are their Heisenberg versions. All right, so I don't want to spend too much time on what these are, but maybe give you a bit of the flavor. Right, so if we have a compression, so we'll skip this, but if we have a compression, so we could have one, you know, these properties of compression, normalized, idempotent, bicomplemented, apply either in the dual or the primal cone, either to effects or to states. If you have a compression on effects and you apply it to the unit, you get something we'll call a projective unit. And we'll call its positive image, which is a face, a projective face. And then these all have complements, which you call p prime, little p prime, and little f prime. Okay. And so a very important hypothesis, which I think will say the pair of state space and effect space are projective, or in finite dimensions, it's the same as this concept of spectral. Every face is the range of a compression, as in quantum mechanics, or as in classical probability. Okay, another reason this is interesting, if you don't think it is that at least in finite dimensions, it gives you a spectral theory that's very similar to the spectral theory you have for Hermitian operators. And in fact, with a little bit of an additional assumption, you can do the same thing in some infinite dimensional settings. All right. The compressions form a lattice. I'm not going to go, I think, deeply into what that means. And it's a very nice lattice. It's orthomodular. And orthomodular lattices are one candidate that people back in the quantum logic days used for a generalization of the lattice of subspaces of a Hilbert space. Okay, it's not terribly important that we know what all this means, but I am going to use the complementation, the lattice operation in defining interference, that higher order interference. Okay, you have the De Morgan laws, you have the interesting fact that if you have this projective convex set, so every face is the range of compression, that means an extremal ray is also the range of some associated compression. And then if you take one of these minimal non-zero projective units, which is going to correspond to an atomic effect, it gives you a correspondence between effects and states, effects P and states P hat. So it gets from the minimal projective units, which are atomic elements, atomic effects, to exposed points of your distinguished base, so to extreme points of your distinguished base, to pure states. And so that's going to do some work. So besides talking about interference, I'll also talk quickly about Alfstein and Schultz's characterization of Jordan state spaces, which are close to quantum theory, as we've heard already several times, using this notion of spectrality, and having this association between, you know, canonical association between states, extreme states, and atomic effects is an important element of that. Oh, so here it is. Alfstein and Schultz showed, and this is a finite dimensional version of it, if you add to the assumption that this convex set is projective, that all faces are images of compressions, the assumption that every extreme point is norm exposed, you don't even need that in finite dimensions, that the compressions on the state space preserve extremal rays, and that, so having this association between atomic effects and extremal states allows you to define an inner product by taking the evaluation of an effect on a state, which is defined just operationally, it's giving you a probability. But now you have an inner product on, let's say, the state space or the effect space, because you just turn the effect into a state or vice versa, and now you can evaluate one on the other. So you get an inner product on the effect space or on the state space itself. So the third assumption is the symmetry of this inner product, or if you like, the symmetry of transition probabilities, which is something Alex got to at some point in his development, you might recall. And also Alex, I don't think he made that, but he may have gotten to this assumption as well. So the theorem is, if the thing is projective and satisfies pure state properties, it's one of these state spaces of formally real Jordan algebras. And then getting more operational meat into what all these statements mean could help you get an operational characterization of something close to quantum theory. And then, as Jared was talking about the other day, considerations of what happens with quantum composite systems can actually get you to quantum theory, probably. There are variants that are actually, this second pure state property is extremely closely related to the covering property that Bob mentioned the other day. And there's also a more geometric property, the Hilbert-Ball property, that you can substitute for some of these. I think I won't get into that.
Yes.
Well, this is in a newer book, but this is sort of a dumbed down version of the theorem, because I skipped some stuff that you would need to say in. So I probably should have said these are irreducible. Well, no. The Jordan. I didn't say the Jordan algebra was irreducible either. So. I mean, the point is, your cone can be a direct sum of different Jordan algebras. Blah blah blah. But that's So this definitely occurs in the new book by Alfstein and Schultz. But I would imagine they pretty much proved it in 76. There's a 76 monograph from the 70s. Then there are two new books from the 90s. Really nice Birkhauser books by them. And the second one contains this material, Geometry of State Spaces of Operator Algebras. So we've defined compressions. They may or may not be extremely intuitive, but you know, they have these nice properties. Certainly they're neutral filters. They have unique complement. That's also a compression. They lead to classical subsets of states. And they certainly have enough structure that we can definitely do a nice version of Sorkin's stuff. So what do? Well, we take a maximal, a barrier might consist of a maximal fine-grained set of compatible compressions. And then a slit in that barrier is another compression, PJ, which is just the join in the lattice of the compressions onto some subset of these this finite set of faces. And what's a K-slit experiment with this barrier? Well, we pick a set of K disjoint. And when I say disjoint, I really mean that these sets J are disjoint. Their meet would be zero. So abusive language. K disjoint compressions, P sub JI, corresponding to disjoint sets JI. Let's re-index them as PI, I going from 1 to K. That should be little k. And maybe define S as the union of all these indices. And let's let our screen just be any observable. The different values 1 through m, different elements of this generalized POVM, these things sum up to the unit, the order unit. So they're a complete measurement in this generalized theory. And we're going to, apply some projection out of this big set, big set of projections, that we can get by joining together these fine-grained ones to get projections onto larger spaces. And we'd let those be our slits. And we'll define a projector PK, which is similar to this thing where we added up the measure on various different subsets, except we don't apply any measure yet. And instead of adding up subsets, we add up projectors of different dimensionalities. But otherwise, it's exactly the same alternating sum. So in particular, if you take the three-slit version of this, this is going to be, all slits open if you like, minus every way of having two slits open. And that should not be a plus. That's very important. So let's do it all out in lattice notation. This is P1 meet P2 meet P3. That represents having everything open. P2, P3, P1, P3. These are the ways of having two slits open, and then we add back having only one slit open. Okay. It's important that these are not, if you just added these projections, you'd be decohering the faces 2 and 3 effectively. So taking this lattice join is the way to sort of coherently combine the projectors. In quantum mechanics, this would literally be the decoherence map, right? X goes to P2 x P3 plus P3 x, or sorry, X goes to P2 x P2 plus P3 x P3 if you added. But you don't do that, so you get P1 plus P2 x P2 plus P3 for this projector in quantum mechanics. That would be the compression. Okay. So we just define these Sorkin-like quantities, and instead of taking a measure representing the probability of getting to some place on the screen. Well, we do evaluate the probability of getting to a place on the screen, if you like, an effect E sub I corresponding to that. And we put in an initial state, and we let it go through the slits by applying this compression. And we say there's K-level interference if the all slits open projector differs from PK, where, if you recall, we added up, starting with all the k minus 1 dimensional projectors, dimensional isn't quite the right word, but the level k minus 1, the k minus 1 slit projectors, and then this alternating sum. So if there's no difference, then this experiment, if we can find a part of the screen where there's a difference, then we have observed kth order interference at the screen. A difference between leaving them all open and doing this funny sum of all the other ways we could have them, sine sum of all the other ways we could have some of the slits closed. And in fact, if this observable is informationally complete, we'll just say the whole experiment lacks kth order interference if for every state you put in, we look at the difference here and it's zero. So that's saying all of these differences are zero for an informationally complete set of E sub I. That means the output state is the same. So the difference between these projectors acting on omega is zero. And in fact, that's just saying the difference of these projectors viewed as an operator is zero. So that's what it means for this experiment to have kth order interference. And then we just say a convex operational model, which is represented by a convex, projective convex set where every face is the range of one of these compressions, lacks kth order interference if no k-slit experiment in the model exhibits kth order interference. And, a k-slit experiment is just a set of k-compatible compressions onto distinct faces of the set. So, we've ported Sorkin's notion to the convex sets framework. Let's try to understand it a little better, and I'll give you our main results about this porting. So in a spectral, in other words, projective convex set, let's say a state omega has irreducible coherence. And this is a little more fuzzy. I just sort of wrote this up last night. The precise notions are going to be on the next slide. But let's say it has irreducible coherence between a set of faces, F sub I, if its projection onto the face F that these faces generate is not in the linear span of the faces that you get from any subset of the F sub I. If I consider every subset of the spaces, of the faces, I still don't have, and look at the projection there, I still don't have all the information about the state. There's something that's irreducibly associated with looking at all these spaces at once, right? The quantum case is I look at this face, all these density matrices, I could look at this, but I still need to find out the off-diagonal density matrix elements. This is the stuff, that's not the linear span of these faces is just the block diagonal density matrices. And that's not enough to tell me what's going on. I need these pieces. On the other hand, if you look at every two-slit experiment for a quantum system and you tell me what these pieces are and what these pieces are, I know the state. I don't need to know anything about three-slit experiments because there is no third-order interference. If there's third-order interference, you could do all the two-slit experiments the thing allows, and you wouldn't be able to determine the state tomographically, I believe. Yeah?
Okay, so you have a map between the states.
I have to admit I was not following all the mathematics, but let me see if I can make some connection to what I am following. So you have a map between states and the points in your column, or your convex set, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're relating it to blocks of the density matrix. That I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to know is, if you have third order coherence, what kind of structure would you have to use if you wanted to use the closest analogy to density matrices? Would you have density tensors or something?
So, I mean, we're working on that. We're thinking about what can you do. Yeah. One possibility you might think about is density cube. But yeah, something like density tensors is definitely what we're trying to move towards. And that's why I was asking you these crazy questions that you knew about positive kinds of symmetric tensors the other day. Okay. And John Barrett actually has thought about in the context of Lucian's higher order theories, which this stuff is somehow quite related to. Some notion of a density cube as well. And so the main diagonal, I don't know what it would have. Maybe they would be probabilities. Okay. So this is sort of a notion of irreducible coherence, higher order coherence. Now, if you have states in F already, maybe you can extend this even to non-projective convex sets. Because you see, if you don't have a projective convex set, there isn't a unique notion of its projection onto the face generated by all these F sub I's, right? Because to specify a projection, you need to specify what you kill, and that's specifying a complement. complementary subspace. But, you know, how do you do that? That's not in general canonical. It is when you're talking about compressive spaces. So that's another reason we want compressions, is to be able to have notions like that. Okay. And you can think of a pure state. Let's say you have two faces, a pure state in the face they generate. You know, you might think of it as a superposition of states and so on. So notions like that. It might help you interpret this theorem. So here's the theorem. For a K-slit experiment involving these projectors on a state omega and an informationally complete final observable, it's equivalent to say there's no kth order interference and to say, as I just defined on the previous slide, omega has irreducible coherence between the faces where one slit is blocked off for each choice of slit. The corollary, which maybe is a little more precise, actually, if we say the K-slit experiment above has no interference for any initial state, that is saying that the face corresponding to all the slits being open so something tells me this is okay, there's some kind of typo here, I believe, but what we want to say is that it lies in the span, not the union. Yeah, this is a subset of the span of the linear spaces generated by all the faces with one slit blocked off. So there isn't any more information you need to get from this K-slit experiment if it has no interference in order to determine the state. You just need to know what's in the span of these lower order faces. Okay. And that's just mathematical. Okay, so that's one of the main theorems. Another thing, nice thing we proved is that if we take convex models whose state space is that of a finite dimensional, formally real Jordan algebra, these things we've been talking about off and on all week, all multiple slit experiments have I3 equal to zero, so only second order coherence. And you might say, well, does anything interesting have third order coherence? We can at least give you an example that actually comes out of Alfsein and Schultz's book, although they weren't using it for that purpose necessarily. They want an example of a convex set that's not the state space of a formally real Jordan algebra, I guess is why it was in there. So, that's not a good killer. Yeah. So, this is in 3D. If you look at it from the top, it looks triangular. But it's puffed up into the third dimension and down into the other dimension, so that if you look at it from the side, it looks basically like this, elliptical. Okay, does that sort of make some sense? So this is a triangular pillow, if you like, or maybe if you look at it another way, you know, it kind of looks like this, but it's sort of hard to draw both the bottom. Yeah, okay. The point is that if you take a point that's not in, so you slice through this thing with this plane and you get this triangle. Think of a three-slit experiment corresponding to the points on this triangle. And if you take something up here, a state that's up here that's not in the triangle, it's going to exhibit third order interference, I3 not equal to zero, with, so it's the first possibility beyond quantum mechanics, quantum mechanical level of interference, for the experiment where the slits are just, you know, P1, P2, P3, or P1 join P3, P2 join P3, P1 join P2, etc. And this basically has to do with the fact that, you know, this thing is not in the linear span of the images of these two-slit projectors, right? This is the linear span. You extend this out. This is the linear span of that face. This is the linear span of that face. It's just this line. And so they just span the plane. But there's stuff outside of the plane. All right, well, given the time, I think I'll just summarize and end. So we explored the notions of projective convex set, or if you like, spectral convex set, and Jordan state spaces. We related these two by reviewing the finite dimensional version of the characterization of Jordan state spaces as projective convex state spaces with these additional properties of compressions preserving extremal rays and of the transition probabilities, which are defined by virtue of spectrality, being symmetric. And then we applied this notion to multiple slit experiments and got these two results that I mentioned. And I think I'll skip topics 5 and 6, as I suggested I probably would. So thanks. Should we turn on the light?
So is that what does that result tell us about possible reconstruction schemes?
Well, it provides a potential postulate, which is I3 equals zero. So depending on how far we can generalize the notion of interference experiments beyond these projective convex sets, in order to use that postulate, you might have to also already assume projectivity of the convex set. But that's a possible that's a possible application. If you said, well, now I don't see, maybe there's not some huge motivation that's operational for saying, let's assume we don't have higher order coherence. But from my point of view, I'm interested in also understanding information processing power of general theories and how is quantum mechanics special with respect to that. So I think something we're planning on doing, certainly Cousin and I, is try to construct models, that are nicer than this one, that have higher order interference and ask, what can you do with that as far as processing information that maybe you can't do as well in quantum mechanics? And then maybe, I don't know if that would give us a firm reason for understanding, for saying, we should have quantum mechanics because we wouldn't want to have this power. But it just gives us a better understanding of where quantum mechanics lies in the spectrum of possible theories.
Now we talked about composite systems, so the experience doesn't lend itself naturally to composition, but at least I found in managing that the major questions in my own hierarchy, that composite systems seem to be going back from the space. Now, what would you feel about that?
Not a lot. I mean, only in the context of we've thought about composition quite a lot. I haven't thought yet much about how composition relates to interference experiments, but it's an interesting thing to look at. It might be that one could get nice families of, infinite families of convex sets satisfying IK is not equal to zero for all K above a certain number, and maybe even do this for every K you choose, but maybe there would be no nice way to combine sets in that, with that level of interference, and then that might be a way of ruling those sets out, if you wanted that type of composition. But there, I think there are a lot of directions to go with this. It's hopefully, I think we might be able to construct these higher order theories that are, in a nice way, very regular versions of them, and then maybe look at some of those questions.
This I find this interesting, that quantum mechanics shows interference, classical mechanics does, but it shows only second order interference and not higher order ones. Mm-hmm. And that reminded me of something that Alex said the other day, quantum mechanics is not more non-classical than it might be. And actually, there seems to be, things of that flavor in a lot of the talks, the talks. The fact, you know, quantum mechanics is different from classical mechanics, but given that it's non-classical, it's awfully close to classical mechanics. I'm just wondering if you feel like that's sort of what's going on here, and if it actually, if other people think that that might be like one way of thinking about postulates for reconstruction.
So, you know,
departure from classical mechanics, but minimal ones.
So I guess, I don't know that I would say it's all that close. It just has a lot of nice regularity, shares a lot of nice regularity properties with classical mechanics. I mean, I tend to think that what Alex was talking about was more a lot of these regularity properties, mm-hmm. right? Like the transitive action on these tests, mm-hmm. Okay, so actually I think spectrality is one of these properties that quantum mechanics shares with quantum theory, shares with classical probability, and even to some extent probably measure theory. You know, it says things like there's this lattice of impressions that is the same, it's isomorphic to the lattice of faces, and it's an orthomodular lattice. Well, that's a very special property that's kind of classical in some way. I mean, orthomodularity is a generalization or weakening of the distributive law, and then you weaken it further by saying it only applies in a particular situation, like where one of the elements is complement of the other. But it seems to give you these, you know, somewhat classical sublattices. So that is sort of a structural way in which things are closer to quantum, closer to classical. But this maybe is sort of a more quantitative way, closer to classical, in which you're saying, look, you got this huge hierarchy of incredibly weird interference relations at every level, and we're just down, and we just took it one level up. So that's a different kind of thing, and that's more in the sense of closeness, I think, and shared structure, actually, closeness to get some metric. Yeah, it's a nice observation. I don't know if anyone else has it.
So an interesting question to think about would be whether there's a kind of down compatibility. So in the case of classical and quantum, classical is corresponds to a restriction on quantum.
Mm-hmm.
It's a restricted set of quantum states that give rise to the classical case. It would be nice if that were true at some levels as well. Would that impose any constraints? I'm pretty sure that can't happen. And the reason it would be interesting is because since we already have quantum interference, it's possible that's only the first step, the first revolution yet to come. But that's only given that we already have quantum interference, that sequence of revolutions is impossible to have this kind of possibility.
Yeah, that's an extremely interesting idea. I wouldn't be too surprised if you can find like second order subsets of this third order theory, but I really don't know.
In the example you have is
what? Which example? That's not a very good example because it's spectral. Yeah. So does it work? Well, there are certainly there are classical.
That's okay, but I quantum interference, that's my question.
Can you get quantum interference? That's a good question. Well, yeah, so I imagine that a state up here can exhibit, if you just look at a two-slit experiment based on two of these alternatives, that you can get second-order interference there. But I'm not certain. That's a good question. So, yeah, even in this simple example, it's worth looking. So I'll write that down. Yeah. I mean, I think so. Certainly, if you take a cross section this way, it looks like a ball. So there's second order in, there's second order interference for sure in this experiment.
But it's the second order interference. So you won't get the whatever it is, I three.
Well, if you look at it, this is also these are a pair of complementary projective faces. Any antipodal pair is.
So the key thing is to get I3 equals 0. Right?
Yeah, this pair will have I3 equals 0. Well, I mean, you can only do a two-slit experiment here. And you'll have interference because... Yeah, because there are things that aren't in this line that will have interference between, that look like superficial.
Very trivial question, really, because that example looks so simple, I assume the lattice in this case isn't that horrible, just like the spiral or interference place any restrictions on the modular lattice.
Presumably it does, yeah. I mean, well, I presume it does. I mean, it's all about. Yeah, I mean, it's entirely defined in terms of these spaces and probabilities for states to pass through these different projectors. But I imagine that you could just find it in a lattice structure. I'm not sure. That's a good question. So I'll write that one down.
This is from the simple algebra that's studied in the one said earlier. So in the classical case, we're not supposed to have any two-state interference at all. So the crucial for the same is a finite dimensional theory that was in pretty theories, of course, will have two-state interference.
I imagine that if you, I think that's a very good question. I imagine that if you defined interference right for those theories, you would not have two-slit interference at the probability level.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. He runs a paper showing that you can get a general K equals M to the power R theory is just very simply, and it's kind of constant. It's a very good description on case. And so I wonder, I'd be very surprised if K equals M Q theory, for example, didn't exhibit kind of the entire order of differences.
So I agree that
it would be a discrete, of course, but just like the seconds,
So you know, that doesn't fall directly into this framework, because I did mention that, you know, we're assuming that this V and this A that are basically duals in the finite dimensional situation, the state space and the effect space, you know, we're using the full dual cone in the effect space, the whole dual and state cone. And so you won't be able to represent that theory. But it would be worthwhile to try to generalize the concept to that setting, especially since this guy has constructed these kind of systems.
Whatever you break the problem, then how are you?